I'm Amy.
I'm Wendell.
And I'm Patrick.
And
this is
Yes
But Why
Podcast. Thank you, Nick Jones, for being on the podcast. I really appreciate you taking the time out of your very, very busy schedule to talk to me.
It's my pleasure.
Awesome. So, Nick, I know you from years ago when we both did performance at the Bowery Poetry Club. And as I recall, you were killing it every single time I saw you perform your show, Jolly Ship the Whiz Bang. Tell me how that got started and how you got to performing that and you know, being in New York, doing that kind of stuff, and what got you into that particular project?
Sure. Well, I went to school for writing, and I couldn't get into any of the writing classes until I met Bob Holman, and he let me take his performance poetry class, and I got sort of into that for a little while. You know, it was the 90s, so people still did that. And then I started adding characters, and I started performing and directing these things I called plays, which were really super surrealistic performance art pieces. And then I went to, you know, I was like, I'm a playwright. And I graduated, and I went to New York City, and I was like, I'm going to be a playwright. But I didn't have any idea what that really meant. And I worked, you know, at some downtown theaters, like as an admin assistant, and realized the way I was able to do things at college just wouldn't work. I didn't have any resources. There was, even then, you know, 15 years ago, it was really hard to find spaces to perform, and I just didn't know what I was doing. So I spent my time with my friend Raja Azar, who was my roommate. Just kind of checking out different performance things downtown. You know, there were a lot more venues there. The Bowery Poetry Club was just opening, but there was Surf Reality and a bunch of places. And there was a place called the Present Company, and they were doing a circus. The Bindlestiff Family Circus was performing, and Raja and I volunteered. And we got involved with the circus folks, and through that became interested in puppetry just as a way to like do something, to perform something, to be part of something, and to sort of live the lifestyle that I saw those guys doing that seemed like what I wanted to do, because there was some narrative stuff. There was, you know, there was jokes and there was bits to write, but at the same time, you know, what I've been doing in college, like making these semi-elaborate plays every semester that then disappeared forever, never to be performed again because they were, you know, very ephemeral and site-specific. That seemed inferior to like what, you know, like a circus performer could do, which is just like have a show like in their body or in their briefcase, that they could just travel around and, you know, be rock stars for the rest of their life or until their bodies gave out. And puppetry seemed like a way to sort of, you know, bridge the gap of like narrative storytelling and theater and just something portable.
Great and freeing about circus folk. I absolutely love that crowd. I mean, I remember the Coney Island Freak Show people that I met at Bowery Poetry Club were, I mean, it was like finally freedom and art.
Yeah. I mean, it felt cool and different, and I wanted to have something to contribute to that subculture, I guess. And so that's how we put together this little act that we performed for the first time in the circus at their open stage night, which was the sort of, you know, it's like the circus equivalent of open mic. And it was just me and Raj and a puppet we'd picked up in Bali traveling that we thought looked like a pirate. And we had we did a sort of vaudeville act with the, you know, where we were interacting with the puppet, which I performed you know, did the voice for. And then the puppet sang a song called Pirate Love while I played, Raj played guitar and I sang. And it just kind of hit in a way, you know, that...
Yeah, it hit. That was a great song.
The puppet was like, went out crowd surfing like that first night. And it just, I think honestly, we just wanted to find something cool we could do over and over again. And it turned out to be that. So, you know, based on, well, I knew Bob. So I had an in at the Barry Poetry Club. You know, he was like, make a show for me. So we took that puppet and we had a weekly series for a while where we tried to write a new sort of new puppet show every week. And they were very low quality puppet shows, but it was the beginning of what was many years at the Poetry Club. And we eventually put together a sort of full-fledged rock opera, you know, with a more fleshed out storyline and, you know, with a band of friends from Bard. And we were doing that every Saturday, I think, for like 8 months.
Wow. That's a lot of shows.
Well, I mean, it was just one day a week, but we kept getting extended. But it was still very underground, you know, like we didn't get reviewed or anything, but there was enough people just coming, you know, and hanging out and seeing the sort of lecherous pirate puppet show, you know, in a sort of bar environment that we kept going. And
it was a beautiful spectacle for sure.
Yeah. And then, and, you know, and then like with that show and with the group Jolly Ship the Whiz Bang, like I sort of felt like that was what I was looking for, which was a sort of, I guess, a performance thing that was all our own, you know, that we could like take as far as we could take, you know. And at one point we were like, yeah, we'll just do this for the rest of our life. You know, this will be like the Blue Man Group. Like, this is our thing. And I became more serious about making puppets and.
Yeah, because there was more than just the pirate puppet when I saw it.
Yeah, there was a lot. I mean, I still, like, I'm in my living room now, and I still have some of these characters, like, lurking around in corners and things. And, you know, and the band got better and better, and, you know, we eventually recorded, like, 3 albums worth of songs, and we did a sequel to that first sort of full show, which was called Sleepless Fishes, and the second show was called Crab Keistador. And then we got invited to Ireland and to Bangkok, and it was just, we were never making money, but we were living an exciting life, you know, for guys in our 20s. So that's all we wanted at that point. But then, of course, you know, getting into your late 20s, you know, some financial realities start to sink in, and the question of like, well, what is this going to become the Blue Man Group, or do we have to think about other things? And the band was starting to go in different directions. Guitar players working on Wall Street, you know, starting a family, and I, you know, had a daughter that, you know, was growing older, and you know, I knew I had to pay for college. So right before everything fell apart, we finally got produced by Ars Nova, you know, as a sort of reviewed show, and it went very well, and that was kind of like the peak of it. And and then we all went off and did different things.
You mentioned earlier friends from Bard. Is that where you went to college, Bard?
Yeah, I went to Bard.
What was the program like? You talk about writing so many plays. Was it like constantly you had writing output that you had to do? You know, how many plays did you produce while you were at college?
Well, you know, my situation was unique because I was actually a literature creative writing major, and I sort of found, you know, these things I called plays through Bob and performance poetry. So I wasn't really in the theater department. So I just, you know, I had to produce a work of writing, which I chose to make a book of plays. But I did one. I wrote and produced a play every semester for 2 years, and then my senior project was, I think, five plays, and a couple of them, you know, weren't produced and never were produced, never should be produced.
But your teachers, like, they must have seen, I mean, you weren't a drama major, but you're like doing all of these performance pieces. Did they try to suggest you switch departments, or were they just happy there was somebody that was doing a lot of work and they were excited that they could support you?
Well, I mean, they were amazing. They did support me. Joanna Galaitis, you know, who's a great downtown theater director from back in the day. She was the head of the program, or she became the head of the program right in my last year, I think. And she came to one of my performances, which was outside of the theater, just like in, you know, the multi-purpose room. And she invited me to direct something in the department. She said, "I don't want you to write it. I want, you know, I think you, I'm not sure what the hell you think you're doing with your writing, but I'd like to see you direct something else, something good." So they let me do that with the, you know, with their resources and like professional designers and actors. And, you know, that was a good experience that they didn't need to offer me. So they did reach out to me in that way. But
there's definitely something magical about you. So I can see people being like, "Oh, let's give him this opportunity because he's actually going to use it." But because, I mean, every time I've ever seen you perform on stage, it's like, you know, I mean, admittedly, the shows I'm watching you do are otherworldly, but I was always so impressed, like, "Oh my God, this guy's a genius." So I'm sure they saw that at Bard as well.
Thank you. That's really nice to say. Because, you know, I haven't performed for years now. I'm retired as a performer, I suppose.
Well, you're giving your words to other people. Believe me, I'm enjoying all the words you're giving to other people as well. But, yeah. I mean, you are a really great performer. You don't have to. Nobody's forcing you to perform. But know that that's a thing you have inside of you. Like, I remember the first time I saw you perform, I was like, "I feel like I'm watching David Bowie, like the first moment he's performing. Like, I'm that girl in the bar in the UK going, yeah, that guy's going to do something someday." Like, it was just, you know, you're really great. And, you know, it's the whole thing. You put all together, you know, the writing and the songs, and I'm sure it also helped that you guys were all friends. You had jokes together, and it like really built a wonderful thing. But
yeah, it was a real ensemble production. You know, I see that even more clearly now. Like, I was the front man of the band, and you know, I got a lot of credit, but you know, we did it together. And that's how I always wanted it to be, just to be like I called it a consortium at one point, because I was just like, I wanted this to be our like theater company or our sort of art collective. But it turned out we were only really capable of doing that one thing. Because most of the guys in the band, they were musicians, you know, they weren't like theater artists. So I did have to write, you know, the stuff that wasn't music and some of the music, I suppose. But my point is, like, I miss performing so much, but I don't know if I could like put another band together, you know, or like put that kind of show together, just because it was something that evolved organically over so many years. And like, I don't have like great musical talent. But I somehow, with those guys, because we were friends and because, you know, we were at that age, I was able to create a universe where I could participate in something musical and theatrical. And, you know, I'm not trying to shit on myself, but I just want to give those guys credit, because it really was like something magical. I believe it was something magical, but it was something we all made together.
Oh, definitely. I mean, the other guys definitely brought a lot to it. I remember just watching the guys just playing their instruments, but they're all like, you know, like their faces and their body were always part of expressing what was going on. If something was like, you know, suspicious, they'd all be like hunched over. If something was exciting, you know, everybody was part of it. That was the best part, is that it wasn't just one person going, this is what you should be thinking. It was like, you know, a bunch of people on stage who were all like, oh my God, check out this wild adventure we're on. It's crazy. And yeah, absolutely. They deserve lots of good credit for that. But I mean, I know how it is. I've had various, you know, projects where it went great. We had a wonderful time, but then, you know, everybody moves past and goes on with their career. I think the nice thing about, you know, getting older is being able to accept the new projects, to be like, to not be so sad when the old projects move past and you go on to the next one, but to be thankful for the experience and say, okay, what's the next thing?
Yeah. Yeah.
So as far as your path goes, how did you go, like, when did you decide, right now your job is primarily writing, how did you decide after producing Jolly Ship and then the band kind of dissolving, how did you decide to move into that? I know that you did work writing plays, were some of them produced off-Broadway?
Well, you know, so initially I was just like, I want to be a writer. I always wanted to be a writer since I was a little kid. And, you know, Jolly Ship was like, was my path of least resistance to be able to sort of be a writer by producing it myself, you know, and because I didn't really excel in like prose and like, I never wrote a novel like I thought I would. But then after Jolly Ship, you know, I was like, I want to be like a real playwright. I'd started meeting like real playwrights and I wanted, and agents came sniffing around saying like, we'd like to represent you, but we can't take the script of Jolly Ship the Whiz Bang and like show that to TV producers or movie producers. It's just, it's wonderful, but you had to be there. The script does not like communicate what it is and it will confuse people. So I ended up, and I'd also met people who I really liked and respected who also seemed to like me, who were doing the Juilliard playwriting program. So that became like a goal for me. And I applied 3 times, you know, with new plays. And then I finally wrote one that got me in. And then that play ended up being produced at Lincoln Center.
Whoa, wait, you applied to Juilliard 3 different times? Like, you were denied and you were like, nah, gonna try again. Second time denied and you were like, doesn't matter, gonna do this one more time. And you really stuck to it? That's awesome.
Yeah, well, I know people who applied more times than that.
Wow. I mean, I hear so many people quitting. Like, so many people, I hear stories of people, like, giving up. And, like, the idea that you and these other people that you know are like, nah, I'm getting this. I'm going to apply until I get in. Oh, that's great. Awesome.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it was easier to justify with Juilliard because if you get into that program, it's free. They actually, like, pay you a little bit just to be there. So it's sort of like the anti-grad school.
Whoa. I had got,
at one point in the middle of Jolly Ship, or not, it was the beginning of Jolly Ship, I applied to Brooklyn College for grad school and I got in for playwriting, but I had second thoughts. I was just like, I can't spend all this money just to go back to writing workshops. I just like, what's the point? But then, you know, fast forward 8 years later, I was like, oh, connections. That's the point. But
But Juilliard, I mean, Juilliard's Juilliard. That's worth 3 times or multiple applications.
Juilliard's Juilliard. And then, you know, I don't like saying this because it sounds so almost cynical in its simplicity. But like once I got into Juilliard, then I got an agent, you know, like before I even went to my first class, like that they just kind of swoop in and you know, you've been given like the stamp of approval and they can sell you now.
Wow. So before you even took a single class at Juilliard, they were like, oh, you're a Juilliard guy. Let's sign you on. Wow.
Yeah.
What was that like? Are you with the same agent now or was it like your first agent experience?
No, I'm with the same agency now.
Oh, that's great. They've clearly done good work.
They have. And that they still use that same play as like a writing sample. Like I've just had meetings recently, you know, interviews for jobs where people are like, oh, we read this play. And I was like, oh, they're still trotting that old thing out. That's amazing. But it's because it's
that's awesome.
It got me my job on Orange is the New Black. And it just, I mean, it was going to be developed into a movie. Now I'm trying to develop it into a TV show. It's just this piece of shit that I wrote like years ago that I just keep, it just keeps on going, which is amazing.
Yeah, it's a really gift that keeps on giving for sure.
Which is, you know, if there's any wisdom in that, it's like you just need to write one thing that people like and it can take you pretty far.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. So as far as like having a writing agent, like what's that like? I mean, it's interesting to know that, you know, you wrote this one play and that they keep using that one play, you know, as a writing sample when they're putting you out there. But like, what else are they telling you to do? What kind of process is there? Like, are they doing all the work? Are they asking you to do different things? Do you have to go schmooze people? How do you do it?
Well, they just send, you know, I mean, it was my TV agents, you know, who sort of did the most work for me initially, I suppose. I mean, I had a theater agent who took me on first, but the TV guys, you know, started throwing me out and setting up interviews right away. And you go on an interview, and if they like you and they like your writing enough, they'll hire you for the show. So I got lucky with, you know, the first season of Orange is the New Black, and then moved out to LA for that. And I've been here now, you know, 6 years. I did 4 seasons of that and 2 seasons of Glow. And now I'm going to do something else, and I'm not sure what it is yet.
Yeah. Working on new projects. Wow. Yeah. So the TV guys got you hooked up with, the Orange is the New Black job. And then, like, what happens when you get a job like that?
Well, I mean, I can just tell you my experience, you know, like they were like, come move to LA immediately and we're going to start. And then I moved to LA immediately and they're like, oh, we actually need another month. So go on hikes. And then when it finally started, we were on the Universal lot and we took many, many months of just a very like open-ended just sort of talking about prison and talking about the book that it's based on in a way that I was like, I can't believe this could ever like produce a TV show at the end. This seems so like structureless, but at some point, you know, someone started took a marker and started writing on a board and we create outlines for episodes and then people are assigned by the boss, you know, which episode to write, and you go off, you have a couple of weeks to write it, you bring it back, everyone tables it, you know, which means just giving you a sort of honest critique, then you rewrite it, then maybe the boss does a pass on it, you go to send to the network, and then you start going into production with these episodes. And once you start filming, I mean, people do it different ways. Sometimes they'll write all the episodes before filming begins. With Orange, we'd write, you know, a few episodes ahead of production. And then once production starts, you know, you film like a 9 or 10 day shoot. And the next episode starts filming like the day after, you know, with a different director who's been prepping while you're shooting the previous episode.
So are you guys as the writing staff there or around during the shooting, or is the one writer of it?
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing I should mention with Orange, it's weird. Cause you know, I moved from New York to LA to write on that show, but it actually films in New York. So then when shooting began,
oh, I wondered, I was going to ask, cause I was like, wait, I swear it's New York. Right on.
Jinji Cohen lives out here and she's a family and you know, it's just the way they were going to do it. But with her, like, again, and it's different shows do it differently. She has the writers produce their own episodes. So you go out when your episode or episodes are shooting. I wrote like two a season. I like working with actors, you know, like I guess because I was a performer and because of, you know, that's sort of the essence of like working on plays. I had to learn the hard way that not everyone appreciates a writer on set, like rewriting things on the fly. And I was yelled at by Andrew McCarthy early on for talking to an actor. And which, you know, upset me a little because I was like, some of these actors I already knew, you know, from just living in New York and working on plays and things. And also I'm talking to the actors because I have ideas to like make their lines better and funnier, and everyone will benefit from that. But that said, you have to sort of feel out the actors because different actors have different capabilities and ways of working, and you know, they need time and space to focus, unless they don't. And I learned on Orange, you know, who could take a curveball at the last minute, you know, and who couldn't. But I bet
you learned a lot about navigating the sort of, you know, some celebrity situation, and then just there's a lot of ego in, you know, creating television and movies and plays and whatnot. So this being sort of one of your, I guess this would be your first foray into television, you have to figure out for the first time, like, oh, wait, what am I supposed to be doing? Where am I? What do they want me to do?
Yeah. And, you know, with Orange, especially because, you know, the home base and the mothership, you know, is in LA, like, you know, as I said, you're like a sort of ambassador, and part of your job is also to like listen to the actors, who could obviously like, you know, call the showrunner anytime, but, you know, in a more like human way, they can complain to you and you can just listen and tell them you'll do what you can, but with the knowledge that ultimately the final decision rests with someone else.
Yeah, but I'm sure it's good to have like a, you know, somebody who you feel connected to in a less businessy, more like personal way to really have a conversation about. And then you learn how to communicate it between, you know, their needs and then what you know the showrunner wants to have happen in the show or how it goes.
Yeah. Also, by the, I don't know if you knew, but like in the final iteration of Jolly Ship, you know, we hired two new puppeteers, Steve Boyer and Julie Lake. And Julie Lake ended up being recommended by me and being cast as the character of Angie on Orange is the New Black, which was nice.
Oh, wow. That's great.
And Steve went on to star in, he was in several of my plays. He was in The Coward in my play Trevor, but then he also was in a play called Hand to God, which eventually went to Broadway, and he was nominated for a Tony. And that play is a puppet play, you know, where he was able to use some of the skills, I would like to take credit, a little bit of credit for this, that he learned in Jolly Ship and, you know, get nominated for a fucking Tony.
Yeah, that's great. Which is that, was Hand to God your play?
No, oh. Rob Askins wrote that. But I'm just saying, like, it's nice to see the continuity of things, and especially to have working relationships that last for years, you know, like I just saw Steve and I see Julie in LA now, and we're still talking about projects, and, you know, hopefully we'll work together soon.
Yeah, I can imagine it's nice to have friends in, out when you're doing, you know, LA business, so that, you know, you feel like, there's some comfort to having people that knew you when you're younger around, so that it's not just all like, oh, yes, I'm very professional.
Right. Well, I haven't had to work in rooms where anyone acts super professional like that, fortunately.
Well, good. I mean, that means that you're having a good experience. I'm glad about that. I mean, and clearly you must have really gotten along well with the people that were on the Orange is the New Black staff, because the showrunner is the same, correct? From Orange to Glow. So you just are working for new people?
There's different showrunners.
Perhaps I misunderstand jobs. Sorry.
Like Ivan, Carly Mincher, the showrunner of Glow, they wrote the pilot, but it's in the same, but Gingy's the executive producer. So it's with her, but it's in the same building, but she's not the showrunner technically.
I don't know much. I don't know as much about television as you do. Believe me, I'd love to know the definitions. I don't know who anybody is.
I'm working with the same family, basically, you know?
What was the biggest learning experience that you had when you were on, while you're working on Orange is the New Black, the first couple of seasons before you were also, writing Glow?
The biggest learning experience.
Just be whatever comes to mind.
I don't know if it's the biggest learning experience, but you know, the experience of Orange is New Black was profound, because you know, we made the whole season like without a lot of oversight. You know, we had like a couple people at Netflix giving us notes, but basically they gave Gingy a whole lot of money to just go and make it, and just trusted her. And then, and I remember, like, you know, being in the editing room for my episodes and watching episodes as they came out, and just thinking, like, is anyone going to like this show? It's this very talky show that's like very gritty. And I don't know if I ever sort of had a feel for like what it was. And then of course, it's dropped all at once, all 13 episodes. And like within 24 hours, you know, it became a phenomenon. And like I remember like just watching it online, you know, and on social media, and just people freaking out. And that was very, exciting. And I guess empowering for us, because, you know, no one told us how to make, I mean, you know, it wasn't my show, but I do feel like we all got to, pitch in and express ourselves in a way. It was, you know, it's not a democratic process by any means, but you do all write it together. And so, you know, you reap the rewards and the glory or the failure in the end, as a team.
How does it feel, that moment, like the idea of dropping all 13 episodes? Like, you've worked so long and you create the entire thing. I mean, I don't know that network television is really much different these days. They usually do the work ahead of time, but you know, just to have all of your work right there.
Well, the downside was, you know, everyone watched it, you know, within a couple weeks, and then they're like, we want more episodes. And we were like, we took like a year to make those 13 hours. Like, give us a moment.
People don't really understand that part.
It's a long time.
Yeah, absolutely.
But one thing I wanted to say, you know, just in terms of like the path to a career, you know, because people are always asking, like, and interested for good reason, like, you know, how you get a job in television or in the arts in a capacity that you can pay your rent. Everyone who's an artist wants to know that. And of course the answer is it's different for everyone. But for me, I will say, like, it was an advantage, you know, by the time I came to Hollywood, that I had such a winding, crooked path, because I have a weird backstory, you know? I mean, I grew up in Alaska, and then I was a puppeteer through my 20s and kind of conned my way into Juilliard. And, you know, that's And I have a child that I had when I was 18. You know what I mean? I just have a, it's been an advantage to me, and I'm self-aware of it now that I have, there's, that I haven't done things right. And I've sort of made in some ways mistakes, but mistakes, you know, become stories, you know, once you're on the other side of them.
You say mistakes. Is it mistakes because do you look at them as mistakes because someone in the, you know, along the way in TV or one of your agents was like, I wish you did it differently? Or is it just your own perception of mistakes?
Well, I guess I was thinking of, you know, my daughter, which was a mistake at the time. It became, you know, the greatest miracle in my life. But also,
oh sure, having a baby at 18 is tough, for sure.
But I, you know, I lived through it, and she's in college now, and that's a whole other story. But you know, just you know, I wasn't thinking practically at any point, and somehow it worked out. And I've had help. You know, I don't want to pretend like it's just because, you know, I'm an American who pulled myself up by my bootstraps. You know, I'm like a white male, straight American, you know, that went to Bard and Juilliard. So like I'm probably a poster boy for privilege, but at least I'm a weird poster boy for privilege. And that's helped me because it's made me a little bit more interesting. I would like to think it, during interviews, if nothing else.
Yeah, they have stuff to ask you, and you have like little anecdotes that keep them interested. That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know.
And your agents must like you. I mean, they've been repping you for quite a while. I mean, you got it right out of Juilliard. That was, you know, how many years ago? 15 years ago?
No, it's less than. I mean, it's like
10 years ago?
9 years ago or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been with my theater agent for 10 years. So, you know, who brought me onto the agency. So yeah, 10 years.
A long relationship like that, that's, you know, makes sense that they develop a good story to tell for about you as they're selling you to the people.
I mean, I tell my own story. I don't know how they sell me when I'm not in the room. You know, I think I'm one of their like quirky writers, I guess. I sort of feel like the box I get put in. And based on the things they send me, you know, to consider for adapting and the shows that they send me. They also weirdly, you know, I've been writing on shows that are like female driven for so long that even though I'm not a woman, like I'm put up for those shows more than anything else.
Yeah, but at this point, you know, especially in the world has gotten a little bit crazier. So, or at least we're starting to talk about it, I guess. So the fact that you've worked on female-led writers' rooms and nobody thinks that you're a jerk means, yeah, they're going to put you in more female writers' rooms because you're safe.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd like to think so. I mean, I've only worked for women all this time, is the truth.
That's great. And that's wonderful.
I was the only male writer on GLOW last season. So,
that's pretty great.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Cool. Does it like feel, do you, can you like feel the, I mean, especially with things like GLOW, do you like acknowledge the changes as far as like, you know, with GLOW, it's like, this is a huge deal. This is like a major show. And even Orange, I mean, you're right. Both of your shows are like tons and tons of women, so much female voices to be put out there. And yet it's complex and there's lots of different points of views. It's not just one thing. Like you must be, you know, feeling like you're at the, or I mean, maybe you don't, but you're kind of at the forefront of, you know, creative expression when it comes to like new strong women characters.
Yeah, well, I'm just happy to be a part of it. It's exciting, and I'm proud of the work we do, and with Orange especially, like, I like to think we sort of kickstarted, or at least put into high gear, the conversation about prison reform. Of course, you know, now with a new administration, it feels like if we helped move the needle towards social justice, it's swinging back, you know.
Yeah, but all those people who were inspired by you are still working. You know, I was just talking about a prison program just the other day. Like, there was a friend of mine in Houston was talking about a prison program that he was helping out with. He's a photographer, and he was helping them to, you know, get prepped for the jobs afterwards and stuff. And like, I worked for a nonprofit where there was a gal whose like whole, she built an entire nonprofit to go in and help female inmates not only be ready to live a regular life, but like to kind of be able to develop coping mechanisms. She taught them like meditation and yoga, and she would go through like, you know, role plays about like tough stuff that they were going to have to deal with, and like figure out ways to communicate that didn't make them feel bad or cause the conversation to immediately go to, oh yeah, I was in jail. So there's people out there, they're working hard. I've seen them. So
there's good people out there. That's for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, your work brings it to the minds of people like me, people who are not involved in it. I'm like, oh, huh, that's a thing. And then I'm working at a nonprofit, and they say, hey, we need to do a showcase. Do you want to work on this thing about prison reform? And I say, yeah, let's do it. You know, so before, I'm sure I would have been like, ah, that seems scary. The only prison show I've ever seen is Oz, and that was horrific. So no, thank you. But, yeah, you know, seemed slightly more palatable when I saw women. I was like, oh, okay, cool. Yeah. Women can do it. But yeah, I mean, as far as the work that you have been involved in, how do you navigate scheduling? Like, because Orange is the New Black is still happening and Glow is still happening and you're working on other projects. How do you organize your schedule and like get it all done and be part of everything and still look for new projects?
Well, you know, recently, every time I speak to people, they say what you said, like, you must be so incredibly busy. But the truth is, we finished filming Glow in January, so I've been not working like a regular job for quite some time. So I have plenty of time to do whatever I want right now. I will start on a new show to be determined soon. But in my downtime, you know, in the hiatus between seasons of a show, which is, it's great that you, if you can afford to have a hiatus, it's great. I like it. You know, some people like just, they immediately start on a new show, as soon as the last one ends.
Well, some people are crazy workaholics. It's nice to have a couple days at the beach.
You know, my daughter's grown up. I'm just a single guy here, so I don't need to do that. And I've been developing things. I wrote a couple pilots, and I've been working on a film. And I'm developing actually, I guess, like three shows right now. And you know, one of them may get on the air someday, or all of them could, or none of them can. That's just sort of the way it goes.
How does that feel? Yeah. Like, I heard you and your other Glow writers when you guys were on the WTF podcast, and I heard you guys talking about the idea that a lot of the stuff that you write just never gets produced. Sometimes it's purchased, but sometimes it's not. And you put all this effort in and then just nothing. How does that affect you?
Oh, well, it's demoralizing. You know, I for me, especially cause I'm so slow, you know, when left to my own devices, I like to sort of go over things again and again. I don't know if I'm a good writer, but I'm a good rewriter, or at least good at knowing what I don't like. So, you know, when I finally get something to the point where I think it's worthy, and then it's rejected, you know, it's hard. You put a lot into it. I don't think I'm alone, but I put all of myself into something. You know, I won't let it be seen unless I'm proud of it. Unless I'm just showing it to like friends who I trust because I need help, you know, which is another story.
Yeah,
and that's,
totally.
That's part of how like I believe things can get so many hours of television can be written so quickly, you know, in a functional writer's room is that, you know, people can bring in things that need work and all these other eyes and brains can identify like where that work should be and like what's missing and can help, you know, fix a script very quickly. But when I'm just like on my own, it's like, well, like this movie I'm writing, it's like, well, it's, I still go back and forth as to like what it is, you know, like what the story I'm trying to tell is. And I don't know the genre. I'm just sort of like feeling my way through something in a very slow, excruciating way. But if I finish it, it's going to be amazing.
I'm sure it will be. Since you've been in LA, do you think you know better now what people are looking for? Like, since you've been through the process a little bit, so when you're editing your current screenplay, are you editing knowing, oh, you know, they like this kind of thing, or this is what people are looking for? Is there anything like that that drives you?
Well, I do know that stuff, you know, like you just sort of pick it up after a while, you know, and you talk to your agents, they tell you what people are looking for. But in terms of like the things I like, this film, for instance, or some of the original ideas that I've written pilots for, you know, it comes from me and like what, you know, it still has to come from like the idea of like what I would like to see as a movie or a television show. Taking a job, you know, as a staff writer is a different, or a producer is a different story than someone else has already sort of decided that. And you were hired to help and that's your job, to support someone else and their vision and add to it, but support. So to answer your question, I guess, it doesn't drive me. Sometimes I actually wish I could like, forget all the things I know or believe I know about like what people are looking for. And by the same token, like you work in a writer's room for a while and you're spending so much time with other writers, the voices of those other writers become like ghosts, you know, that haunt you. We might have talked about this in the WTF podcast, but it's like I hear all the other writers I've spent years in a writer's room with, you know, as I'm writing my own dialogue, you know, I hear someone say like, well, that doesn't, you know, it doesn't seem logical, or someone saying like, this seems too boring or that's too quirky. Whereas before, you know, when I was just writing a puppet show, I never had a voice in the back of my head say like, that doesn't seem logical. You know, it was all just like, will this make people laugh? And like, you know, is this true to the character?
Well, a pirate ship puppet show, not exactly the most like logical story to begin with. Never mind, you know, oh, should he fall in love with the cabin boy? I don't know if that's logical though. Like, yeah.
But you know, it's a trade-off, because at the same time, I'm trying to apply the lessons I've learned, you know, in terms of more nuanced writing, but I'm also at the same time always trying to get back to the joy, you know, of the puppet shows and the absurdity, and to find the right mixture of that, you know, stupid puppet sauce and the other stuff that is, you know, like in Orange is New Black, you know, where something becomes like, feels like it's about something, it's socially relevant, and it gets to the truth of how people behave. I'm trying to walk that line always with everything now. Like I don't want things just to be silly and just to be, you know, art for art's sake. But at the same time, I could never write on a show that's just about a relationship, you know, without something hyper real, you know, or clever, I suppose.
Yeah, it's good that you're out there and also conscious of the social message of what you're putting out there. It should be interesting to see what other projects you find out there in LA that have the social messages that you're looking to put into your work, but also give you the creativity to maybe put some fun into it. I look forward to seeing all of the work that you do in the future for sure.
Thank you.
I'm, in fact, very much looking forward to the new season of GLOW about to start. So congrats on that. I know you said you finished it months and months ago, so it's very over to you. But it's going to be new to us in minutes. And, you know, we're all very excited about that kind of situation. As far as your, like, if you had any advice, just to sort of wrap it up, if you had any, I mean, you've given some great, great advice, and thank you for being conscious of the idea of my audience, which is people who are trying to get jobs and like giving them the advice of like, you've got to, you know, work it your own way and develop your own story and get there, you know, and that's really great. If there is a person who's a writer and they're not based in LA currently, what kind of advice do you have if they're not going to Juilliard to, you know, what do they do to get noticed? Do you think, and maybe your experience, you don't know, but what do you think?
I mean, you gotta self-produce, you know, whether it's whether you're a stand-up or you're doing sketch comedy or you're doing something theatrical, you gotta figure out a way to just do your thing in front of people and suck at it, but get better and develop your instincts, you know, in front of an audience. And that's just the craft part of it. In terms of all the other parts of it, which, you know, include like getting an agent and all that, like, I guess you just, you can't think about it too much, I guess, you know, you, like they will come if you build it. Build it first and they will come, and just like try to find the thing that like you care about, that is you and is honest to like what you want to see, you know, as an audience member, and just try to make that thing the best version of itself that you can. And for me with Jolly Ship, if that was the thing that sort of put me over the top, it took 8 years, you know. We did that show for 8 years, and it started off as a joke, and by the end it was a pretty impressive joke. So
awesome. Yes, well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to chat with me, and thank you for being so open about sharing your experience and the advice that you've given. Congrats on all the hard work and the great output that you've done over the past few years, and you know, really excited to, you know, support everything you're doing in the future.
Thank you, Amy.
Awesome. Well, have a good night.
You too. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why podcast.